Welcome to the Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Josiah Smelser. The Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast is the shared journey of building a real estate investment property business from square one. Join me as we learn together how to conquer the real estate game to reach financial freedom. Together, we will learn from people in all areas of real estate and business in our personal trek towards escaping the rat race. Be you. Do the work you love. Play the long game. Before we get going, make sure you're subscribed to the show on whatever audio platform you're using and jump over on YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Daily Real Estate Investor. We have shorts coming out daily as well as these podcast episodes on video. Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm excited to be back for another episode. I've got a wonderful guest today, a friend of mine, James Daynard. James, welcome, sir.
Hey, good to see you, man. It's been a minute since we teamed up in person.
It has. I was excited to see you were coming on the show. So I do appreciate you sharing your time with us. So for those of you who don't know, which I'm sure a lot of you do, James hosts a show for Bigger Pockets called On the Market. That show airs twice a week. So if you're not following that, definitely go check that out, because James is the man when it comes to real estate. He's got a lot of experience in doing value add projects, doing flips, he puts out all kinds of cool content. So I definitely want to make sure you guys go and connect with him if you aren't already. But James, let's dive into your story, man. Tell us how you got started in real estate, and then we'll talk about some of the current things you're working on.
Yeah, it was longer ago than I remember. It's funny. I got involved in real estate when I was 22 years old, senior in college. So I was like a young kid. And now today, like, I always think I'm like the young guy going in the room now. And now what I'm really realizing is I'm not the young guy in the room anymore.
Dude, it's wild to feel like we're getting old. I mean, I'm 42. How old are you now?
I just turned 40.
Yeah. I mean, I remember looking at my dad and thinking, you know, when I'm 40, you know, I'll dress like he dresses and I'll be, you know, it's like, I'm 42 now. It's just crazy.
Yeah. You thought you were wearing like all Dockers.
Yeah.
At 40.
You know, like a button up and like khakis, you know? And I'm like, man, 42, what's it going to be like in 10 years? We're in our 50s. I mean, isn't that crazy?
You got to stay on it.
Yeah, I know.
You just got to, sure. And I think real estate keeps me young, because it's just this constant grind and it just keeps you moving.
It gives you some gray hairs, but it keeps you young at the same time.
For sure it does. It for sure does. But yeah, when I got started, I was 22 years old. I was actually a senior in college. And the only reason I really got into, I always loved real estate. I had worked in a warehouse when I was a kid, fulfilling marketing orders for a company that sold marketing products to realtors. And so I understood real estate, and I had bought a piece of land when I was 17 with my IRA and sold it and flipped it off and made like $6,000. And so like, I kind of understood the fundamentals behind it, but how I got involved in the business is I was senior in college, and my roommate, or who's my business partner today, he took a job at a local investment company that would door knock, find off market deals. They would buy the deals. And so for me, I was going into my senior year and I'm like, hey, I want sales experience, because I was trying to get into medical device sales. And so I took this job knocking doors. When I was a senior in college, I was kind of working three jobs. It was go to school full time twice a week, work as a bartender on the weekend, like 35 hours. And then I would bang doors 3 to 4 days a week after I got done with school or I had free time. And you know, so we started off as wholesalers. And, you know, what we kind of realized was, as we started wholesaling and sourcing the deals, that the real money was made on flipping the properties and all the other services, the things that come together. And so after my senior years of college, I kind of decided that I wanted to stay in the business, which I was shocked, because I made a whopping $0 my first year, like zero. I was definitely in the red, because I had closed one property. I had paid way more for gas than I did on my commission check on that deal. But I saw all the potential, and I really I started really loving real estate. And from there, you know, as soon as I graduated, I went full time, trained myself, dove really deep into self-education, and then tweaked my wholesaling business. And then from there, it was just a domino effect. You know, from starting to flip houses, now we lend money, we build homes, we do multifamily syndications, we do multifamily purchasing on our own rentals. And it's kind of grew over the last 18 years to 8 different businesses in the Pacific Northwest that just either service investors or are all investment related, where we're buying, selling, adding value, and either dispoing them or keeping them in our portfolio.
Dude, that's amazing. That's amazing. And then where along the way did you pick up hosting this Bigger Pocket show you're doing?
That was a pure accident. So this is a funny story. So how I actually got into Bigger Pockets, and I hate to say this, but I had no idea what Bigger Pockets was. Because I'm really a deal guy. So since I was 22 to now, I was so ingrained in the business. I wasn't really watching other states. I was just in Washington. I was going to own my territory. And so I was really connected in the Pacific Northwest, and we were doing a lot of deals, but I never really looked outside. I didn't do a lot of podcasts. Everything I ever taught myself, I did read books. I would study on the internet. And I'm one of those people that goes and learns concepts. I go, hey, this is what I want to do. I'm going to figure out the nitty gritty. So I dive deep into the nitty gritty. And how I got into Bigger Pockets was I was actually at a conference we were sponsoring. And some guy I knew that I'm pretty competitive with was bidding. It was a public auction. He was bidding on a host appearance on Bigger Pockets, or a guest appearance. And because I was competitive with the guy, I just started running up his bid. And then I ended up winning this thing. I hop on. The show went really well. I had no idea who Brandon Turner was. I had no idea who David Green was. I just get on. I'm like, this guy's got a big beard. That's all I knew. It went well. And then from there, Bigger Pockets started having me do some YouTube videos for them. And then they cast me for the On the Market podcast with David Myers, Kathy Fecky, and Henry Washington. And it's just a great show, but I've really enjoyed it.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, when we first met, I knew nothing about social media at that mastermind. It was like all a bizarre space for me. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, it's a different animal, because it's like, You unlock a whole new world of just connections. And I mean, it's like, you know, like you're saying, like, there are people out there that don't do any social media, that are unaware of all the stuff that we're seeing on social media all the time. And I mean, it's like, it has developed me so much just to watch some other people's content. I mean, there's like 3 or 4 entrepreneurs that I watch on a regular basis that I learn so much from. And so just putting out content, it's a wonderful way to market yourself, grow your own network, and then watching quality content from others is another great way to grow as a business professional. And I know your show is helping a lot of people. I know you just got finished with the Bigger Pockets conference, and that seems like that's ballooned to a crazy number. How many people are there this year? You got any idea?
I think there's 3,000.
3,000, man.
Yeah, right around there with the vendors and the attendees. It was a lot of people. It was crazy to be on stage and see like that many bodies in the chairs. So I was like, what is going on?
And to go from not knowing what it is and not doing any social media to that, that's a wild evolution.
Yeah, and I think it's because, you know, for us, you know, we are deal real estate guys. That is what we do. Like you said, there's a lot of people not on social media, and they're probably the best of the best. And they really know how to build businesses, revenize them, invest correctly. And that's what we kind of, we don't go with what's trending. We just kind of do what we are doing today. And we just want tangible steps. And I think that's why we've done well, is just because, hey, this is what you got to do to get to that next step. This business is harder than what it's made out to be.
Yeah. You definitely don't get the full picture from a piece of content where somebody says, hey, I got this property and I renovated it and I made 60K. It's like, you're not getting all the problems, you know? So, and then there's the scaling part of the business, which you're doing. You've got multiple businesses now, but, you know, going from flipping one property by yourself to building a business flipping, it's a completely different animal, and to doing lending, and, you know, you have a number of businesses. Let's get into that. Let's talk about, you know, how you built your businesses and what your strategy is with all this. Are you trying to build a Berkshire Hathaway here, or what are you trying to do with this?
You know, we're way more boutique. How we've scaled our business is just providing services on the next step every time. And actually 2008, 2009, and 2010 is where we really had, that's the reason we have so many multiple income streams, because, you know, when the market, we started wholesaling and doing deals in 2005, everything was great until July of 2008. And then the market went into a free fall, and we had just gone off on our own, started our own business, put all of our money into that business, and then the market just crushed. It just got annihilated. And it, what had happened for all those that were in the business at that time, it was this slow grind, but nobody wanted real estate. It was like, it had leprosy. Do not give that to me. Couldn't give it away. And so we were really good at sourcing off-market deals, but then people are like, I don't want to deal with this. And so what happened is we started opening up multiple income streams, which was the brokers was the first, or the first thing we had to do was line up funding, because it was really hard to get hard money or any kind of financing after the banks all had just collapsed. And so we ended up starting our own hard money business just to provide the capital for people that could buy our deals. From there, it was the next step was, how do you mitigate risk for these people? And we had become, because we were finding deals, we had the money, we were flipping a lot of properties. It gave us a very specialized skill set of, like, hey, this is what you can do to make money with this, and we'll show you. And then that's where our brokers kind of took off, because that is implemented into our broker services. So we're not like the big shops. We're very boutique services that source on and off market deals. We provide the financing for investors to take it down, but then we walk them through the process as a part of our commission, as far as like getting them contractor referrals, designing it for them, helping them stay in budget. And that's really where our businesses exploded. Wasn't the investment side first. The investment side taught us the skill set to provide the highest and best possible services, which then blew up our brokerage, which then elevated the amount of loans we were doing, which gave us more capital. And that's what blew up our investment business by kind of implementing these income streams. And so every year we're always going, what's the next logical step? Not going and chasing something that we're not typically doing. It's just like, how can we make the client experience better? This experience is also going to provide us with additional resources, money, experience, and just resources. And then that's how we've really scaled and grown. And I think that's a big mistake people make, is they chase the shiny object, like, this guy's crushing it doing this. So they jump and they jump and they jump. Whereas we just take a small step and go, how can we revenue this, add this extra piece in?
Yeah, I love that. So you recognize an opportunity, you know, 2008 made you realize that you can't get financing, right? So you got deals for sale, but nobody can qualify. So you've got the brokerage, but you start building out the lending arm of the whole thing. And then you build services around that to help people manage contractors, manage their renos, make sure, you know, because that's a big part of this, is somebody could buy a property that wants to get into investing, but they don't really know what they don't know, right? So they got to figure out how to get the deal properly renovated, how to properly structure the financing. There's a lot of stuff that people need coaching on or consulting on with this stuff. And there's kind of a void in the market for that sometimes. There's coaching programs, but those are expensive, right? You don't want to go buy a $20,000 coaching program to do one flip. So you guys created this solution to help people be able to not only find the property, but to take it down with the financing and then help them figure out how to properly run the reno and scale and that kind of thing. So that's really cool. So you said that built the investment side of your business. How so? Like, were you taking profit from these businesses and going and doing, what kind of investment properties are you buying, or what was your strategy there?
Yeah, because it's all about, you need capital to grow in this business, whether access to capital or you need capital. And back then, especially, capital was hard to find. Like nowadays, even with today's rates, you can still get capital. But It was really key for us to introduce these multiple streams, because it just created more and more net income every year. And not only that, it expanded our brand, but the income, we reinvested a lot of money 2008, 9, and 10. We did not take very many paychecks during that time. It was like, what do we need to live? Everything else was getting reinvested, because we were also trying to rebuild where I just got crushed in 2008. You know, like, I had to get rid of a lot of my rental properties. I had lost, you know, all the money I had saved grinding and wholesaling got evaporated. And so we reinvested. And then what we started with was flipping, because flipping is that you need the least amount of capital for on a reinvestment and will give you the highest possible return many times. You know, average flipper, especially back then, we could make 50% returns on our investment in 6 months, which would allow us to grow quicker. We would then compound that roll back by more flips. And then as you start bringing in more capital and your skill sets kind of increase, then we started building homes and building townhomes, you know, because you need the money to get going. So by reinvesting and compounding it, it kept this huge, you know, bank of, you know, we just had this vault of cash that we could always reinvest and grow it. So we stuck with high growth investments at first, which is fix and flip development that grew the cash. We reinvested that, bought rental properties. And during that time, we were focused a lot of Burr style properties that had big land with it, because we knew dirt wasn't worth a lot then, but it became a gold mine 5 years later. And so we, you know, 25% of our flips, we would buy rental properties that were on land, acquire that. That was 10 doors. You know, I'd say over the 3 years, we probably picked up about 30 doors. And then that gave us the gunpowder then to then grow more capital by growing equity and then 1031 and exchanging that out to where we have almost 1,000 doors from those original 30. And so we're very high growth chasers. Whatever's going to give us the most equity, the most cash, that's what we're just going to reinvest. We defer a lot of our cash flow. I don't, like, we have a really good portfolio that cash flows at 10 to 12%. But that's not what I'm going to retire on. It's that equity, big growth, keep reinvesting it, keep growing it, and then get into that final where you just park it on something and then you can live off the cash flow. So short-term pain, long-term gain. Just roll your profit, forget the cash flow, get equity and trade it out.
Gotcha. So you're doing this full-time, right? This is a full-time thing. When you got the 10 doors, I know you are now, when you got the 10 doors, were you doing, did you have another job? If you're rolling all your profits in, how are you living off that?
No, that was our full-time job. What we did is we put ourselves on pretty small salaries compared to what our profit was. I would say we were pulling out like maybe 10% of profit throughout the year.
Right.
Okay. We were leaving most back in. Yeah. It was pay the bills, have a little bit extra, let's grow this thing.
Yeah. I love it. So 1,000 doors, how's that structured? Is that mostly, like, is that apartments or what's the makeup of that?
It's a mixture. So I'd say 50% of those roughly are through syndicating that we've just done, you know, our average syndication deals. We kind of like to play on no man's land. Yeah. So we like 30 to 60 units where the big guys aren't playing, but then the mom and pops aren't really playing in either. So we go wherever the deals are, but that's kind of our sweet spot. The other 50% are a mixture of rooming houses that we own. We still own single family rentals. I'm not one of those people that goes, oh, I'm in multi now. Single family's not good enough for me. I love a single family deal because there's so much growth in them, right? Yeah. Like, we will buy anything. So we still have single family on some big lots that we can develop later. But, you know, most of our, you know, I would say out of that, it's a lot of 10 to 20 unit apartment buildings, rooming houses, and we some fairly large rooming houses too, like over 70, 80 doors in them. And then make sure single family, I will always buy single family. I don't care what people say. You can make money on single family.
Yeah. And what market did you start in? And you, are you all over now? Or are you kind of in the same area or how's that look?
So I own everything in the Pacific Northwest. Okay. We work in King, Snohomish, Pierce County, mostly in King County, which is going to be like Seattle and Bellevue, your two anchor cities of Washington.
Gotcha.
Reason we do it is I just understand the market best. And we have so much relationships and years in this market. It doesn't do me, I would love to get out of the unfriendly landlord market because it's not awesome in Washington, but we just know it. So the more you know something, the more you can reduce risk. Yeah. And so as I'm trying to grow, I just stay in the areas that I'm most comfortable in. But I am looking in some other markets right now because I would love to grab some stuff that where tenants, if they don't pay, you can get them out.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to quickly talk about some of the stuff that's going on that I've read about in Seattle and your opinions on it. And then I want to talk about how you were taking these deals with a property there with some extra land, how you're building on that and going through that whole process. I think that would be valuable for the audience to hear. But first, give me your opinion on what's going on with the commercial spaces in downtown Seattle. And I've seen like a lot of the vacancy seems to be going up. And I know it's like you're saying, it's challenging to get tenants that aren't paying out. There's a lot of issues with crime and that kind of stuff. Like, fill me in. I don't live up in that area, but like, how much of that's true and what's really going on up there?
I would say that Seattle has definitely changed a lot over the last 10 years. The commercial spaces, and I think it's kind of similar to all major metro markets though. commercial's just not in high demand. Businesses are not, you know, I mean, there's so many things that come into play with that, right? Your leverage, people to get their businesses started costs a lot more. Landlords are running out of cash a little bit, so they don't want to pay for all the massive TIs. And so it's kind of becoming this kind of flat market. I do see a lot of tech expansion still. And Washington does have a lot of runway still in commercial, because if you look at, it's becoming a mini San Francisco in the tech space, but it doesn't have a 13% income tax. And pricing, to, you know, it is expensive, but it is still cheaper than, you know, San Francisco. And so people can get a lot more. And as what we've seen across the pandemic is people want more, they want more lifestyle than they'd want location, right? People are moving into more affordable markets. So we are technically the more affordable tech market, even though we're expensive. So I do like that. There's still a lot of innovation. There's a lot of growth. I think people need that extra 13% nowadays. And so it is, I feel like the commercial space has still has some runway. The small stuff is not quite getting leased up, but overall being a landlord every year gets more and more difficult. It's, you know, we do have a high homeless population. If the homeless population breaks in, they show a copy of a lease, we have to evict them out. We can't even just remove them from the property. And so I would say every city is going to have something you got to work with. And so you just have to navigate around the landlord laws, the tenant laws, keep your property secure. But we have very little issues with our portfolio. If you renovate your property and is stabilizing, you're renting to the right demographic, right? Because we're not the high-end luxury, but we're also not the slumlord. We're right in the middle. Everything's nice. And you give people a good quality of living, your rents are collected. It's not like you can never get rent. Like even during pandemic, we collected at 93%. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you have good buildings in any market that attract good tenants, your issues are not going to be good. So just be a good landlord and you'll get good tenants.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff. Let's shift gears and talk about, you were buying these properties where you had, I would guess, a single family home sitting on the land with some extra land. And you said, you know, land wasn't necessarily as valuable then, but you saw the potential there. Let's talk about what you do with a property like that, how to maximize your return on that.
Yeah, these are my favorite deals, especially in today's market. Back in 2010, a lot of people were looking for land and building. So how it all started is we started flipping homes and go, hey, we got this extra lot here. And so then we would carve off the lot, flip the house, make 40 grand, 50 grand on the house, and then we'd have a free lot. And then either we would spin that lot to a builder for 7,500 grand, or, you know, but once we saw the potential and the profit there, then we started building. So it was a nice step for us because we could get the land for free, which gave us a big margin of error. But as the market improves, those opportunities start shrinking, right? And so now it comes to the point where, you know, 2018-19, we were flipping a house and getting a lot for like 100 grand, which would be about 50% less than we could buy it for. But as you go through market cycles, you want to look at the opportunities. So those deals weren't as attractive to us from 16 to 20, 21 even. But as today, what we've seen is rates have skyrocketed again. It's hard to make things affordable, and these fixer properties on large lots, the pricing has dropped 20-25% on these things. And because everybody's looking at them with the same glasses, like, hey, if I buy this property, I renovate it, I rent it out, I'm going to lose money every month. And like, that's not a good deal. And they move on. And so it's kind of gone back into no man's land because dirt has fallen in our Seattle market 35% on pricing. The demand for fixer rentals has dropped 50%. Because the rates don't make sense. And for the traditional investor just not looking outside the box, they pass on these deals. And so what it's done is I've been really focused on buying, getting in contract on properties that are just houses that I can keep, break even, make a little bit of cash flow on, or even take a little bit of a loss. But in metro cities, they're pushing density right now. They need more housing. We're short a million houses right now in today's market. So as they need more density, they need more land. They've upzoned everything. And so now what you can do a lot in the Seattle market is you can buy a rental property, break even, but then you can build an ADU, a single family house, a DADU, or even townhomes on the back of these lots. And in today's market, with the dirt being down 35%, it might not be what I'm going to build out right now. But when I know rates come down, that value is going right back up, which is going to build a huge amount of equity in that property that I can then 1031 exchange out for multifamily. I can increase my doors. I can increase my cash flow by that huge equity gain. So because dirt's really deflated right now and the demand for fixer houses is deflated, it allows this kind of no man's land opportunity where that's where we've been really focused on is, okay, hey, you know, if this stuff was selling for $750, now we can buy it for $590 in a 12-month period. That's huge value. So we chase value rather than just cash flow.
Sure. I love that. So how does someone that hasn't done that before find one of these deals? Are you looking for a house or a property typically that's got, I'm assuming, you know, if you've got a property on sitting on a half an acre and I guess maybe the house is off to one side of the lot, are you going and looking at zoning regulations and trying to figure out, you know, what size lots required in that neighborhood to be able to build something? Or how are you, do you have a team working on this? Like, how are you finding these?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we focus on is in metro. So a big lot to us is 5,000 square feet.
Okay.
And we're like, okay, we got 5,000 square feet to look for. So what we look on those things, if you want to get going looking for these, you want to hire the right real estate broker. The person that understands what you're trying to accomplish, because there's a lot of great brokers out there, but very few of them understand dirt. And so, because you have to buy the right one too. There's nothing worse than buying the wrong piece of land that all of a sudden you didn't understand. You got to bring in utilities. You got easements coming through. It can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get your site built ready. But what we target on is, well, A, the first thing is get a good broker that understands what they're looking at. That broker is going to look for properties where, yes, the position of the house, is it in the front of the lot? Is there access? Is it on a corner? Like, so the ones that we chase are houses that are on the front of the lot on a corner with an alley access, because in the metro cities, they run on grids a lot of times. And the more access you have for your property, the more usability you have on it. You can get different driveways in at that point. You can set up garage spaces, different types of access. And the further your house is to the front, the more FAR coverage, and that's the floor area ratio, the more buildable footprint you have to work at inside, because you got to watch setbacks. So we're targeting those because the house is in the front. It gives us setbacks to build inside there. And a setback is what the city says this house needs to be put away from other properties. Then with extra access, that becomes a lot of additional value. But how we chase those is we're looking at the comparables, because like in Seattle, you could build a DADU, which is a detached ADU, right? And it's a big deal right now because you can buy a house, build it in the back, condoize it off, sell the two properties separately, and get a big margin. But if you buy the wrong one with the wrong access, the value swings can be like 35-40%. Like some sell for 500 grand, sell some for 850, and they'll be the same size. It comes down to parking, location, and access. And so for us, we work this backwards. We go, what is the highest selling possible product with the highest price per square foot? Because we know we can build the same structures for the same price per square foot. That's going to give us the biggest margin. And then we put together a selling list and a trap list for lots with that same type of setup.
Love it. So a deal, you know, one deal selling for $850, the next selling for $550. I'm guessing the 550 maybe doesn't have the alley access, is sharing parking with the house in the front, or how does that work? Like, well, what would the difference on those values are?
Yeah, and that's been a big trend, and part of like what we talked about earlier was crime has gone up in Seattle. So people want parking, they want safety, they want garages. And so with the access, sometimes when they're buying these houses, you'll get it could even be a bigger lot, 7,000 square feet, but the house stretches the entire lot. And so you have to build this DADU, DADU, in the back, but the person has to park on the street and walk down a path to get to their house every day. That's inconvenient. With, you know, when crime's a little higher, it makes people nervous. And so right now in today's market, people want what they want. Their interest rates are all-time highs, or at least over the last 20 years. If they're buying that property, they don't want to be worried about an objection in 12 months. So people are thinking a lot longer. And so they'd rather spend a ton more money and get exactly what they want rather than a weird, you know, kind of a weird access. But people, you know, location, location, location. We hear that in real estate. That is just, you know, it's no different than that. If you have the right property with the right access, right area, it's going to sell for substantially more. But it's also how you can get yourself in big trouble as a developer if you're not analyzing these properties correctly.
What's the best case scenario on one of these deals that you have experienced? And what was the biggest mistake you made when adding a unit to a lot?
Oh, best case scenario is, you know, when it catches on fire, right? So like when we first started doing this, when the trend actually becomes a trend, when you're thinking it's a trend, becomes the trend. And so originally we were buying these things and no one had built these DADUs. And we're like, what are these going to sell for? And we all were thinking they were going to sell for substantially less than they ended up going for. And we didn't realize how much affordable housing and how much people were okay living in the backyard. Even me, I was like, why are all these houses going in the backyard? This is going to be weird. We, you know, some of our performas, because the consumer actually realized they liked it better than townhomes. They get a little yard, they get a garage, and they have no shared walls. We were evaluating townhomes for higher than these before we started building them because they had more planned community. It felt better. You weren't in someone's backyard. We thought the vibe would be better. But what happened is the livability increased it so much that these things jumped up at like 35, 40% higher than we thought. And we were selling these things for way more. So that's the benefit, right? When you're building a good product and, you know, you roll the dice and it still works, but then it goes a lot better, right? The consumer really loves it. The negative thing is that you can deal with on these properties is your utilities. If you are underestimating your utilities, you know, like if your water line is too small for two units, you got to rerun your water line. Or let's say you need to do a sewer main extension because as you do more density, the soil has to be better. It has to be able to drain better. You know, many of these cities are requiring you to upgrade the drainage, but then the land, because you're building so many more units on the land, it won't drain correctly. And you have to bring in big sewer main extensions. That can be $1,000 a foot in Seattle. And so if you miss your utilities, you could be off by $200,000 to $250,000. Or there's another buyer I just heard about. This company came in, they bought like 30 of these properties, but they didn't understand the market. They were from a different market. They didn't realize that the area they bought them in, they were the best selling area for pricing, but there's CC&Rs in this area. So it wasn't title, it wasn't zoning, or it wasn't zoning, it wasn't utilities. It was in, there was an overlay deep in their title with a CC&R saying this was not allowed. So they bought probably $10 million in real estate and they can't even build it. So that's the nightmare. So you got to dig in. And it's really important as you go into development that you have a good architect, you have a good structural engineer, you have a good civil, and you have a very good developing team. Because when you go into feasibility, we don't know this. We have thoughts behind what you can put there, but they're going to verify. You have to verify all these costs during the feasibility.
And so I'm assuming that after you get this property under contract, you're getting all this feasibility stuff done before you close, right? To avoid what happened to these other guys.
Correct. Yeah. So typically we have 14 days to run our feasibilities. We're testing soil. We're checking for contaminants. We're looking at zoning code. We're reviewing title. And we're going through all this because another reason we do that is if there's going to be a big delay in construction, because this is another major mistake that we've made and we see other people make it too, is when you transition from flipping to developing. Flipping, we go in with quick close numbers. My average offer timeline is 5 days. I will buy this and I will close in 5 days. I do that to get the better deal, gives them a better, more convenient sale. They want to work with you more. In developing, if you get trapped in permits, it can be 4 months, it could be 6 months, it could be 18 months before you get your permit. And if you close that quickly, and it's going to be 12 months and you didn't account for it, that's 12 months of debt cost. And in today's debt, that will wreck you. And so during that feasibility, we're also verifying timelines. What do we think this is going to be? If it's 4 months longer, we're going to ask that seller during feasibility to extend closing and say, hey, look, either we have to get a haircut on the price or we can close on at the same price, but you got to give us a delay to get us a jump on the permits. And so, yeah, the point of the feasibility is to verify your build cost, your plan, but also your debt, and to make sure your whole package is set up right so you can be profitable at the end.
How many of these have you done?
So we built probably 20 of these right now. We've sourced about 60 or 70 to investors too. So we do all the listings for them. And then we still build a lot of townhomes right now because townhomes, great. You have four to eight units on one side. You keep all your team there, reduces your build costs. So we are definitely density chasers. We don't build a lot of just straight single family houses.
So out of the 20 that you've done yourself, how many of these, what's your batting average? Like how many of these have made money for you versus have you had any that lost money?
Well, in development in general, and I'll kind of put them two in the same, the townhomes and the dadus, because it's a density play. We did really well on the first runs because we got the dirt so cheap and it wasn't a hot topic, right? And we kind of invented our own plan at that point, which is great because no one else is looking, or very few were. But as the trend catches on, pricing rips up. So we've done fairly well throughout almost all of our sites, but where we did get, you know, everybody got caught, ourselves and developers, was, you know, when we bought these things, like a townhome site, we bought these townhome sites 12 months ago. We're putting them on market right now. The debt cost 12 months ago from your construction lender was 6.5%. Now it's 10, 9.5. And so those deals have became very flat all the way through. And we're just trying to get through the inventory because that is part of this whole business. You can't time the market. But, you know, it's just, you're going to be what you're going to be. You got to sell through, get your cash back, reload. I would say the last 3 to 4 development deals we've had have been not, they haven't been in the red, but they are not very, you know, we're squeaking by with a very thin margin. I would say our cash on cash margins is not great. But you get your capital back. And then what we have done is reloaded, bought more stuff that has been very profitable. And so it's just about buying through those waves. But yeah, it's with the debt cost and the construction cost all racking up in the same 12 months, it ate through a lot of profit.
Yeah, it's so important as an investor to have wide enough margins on your deals to be able to weather changes in the market that are outside of your control, like what we're experiencing now, right? You entered these deals 12 months ago, you did your due diligence, you got your numbers nailed down, and then there's changes in the market with rates. And, you know, the Fed is trying to bring the cost of housing down. So they've stated that, you know, so, but there's still a housing shortage. So you've got these tensions in the markets that are going on, but 12 months ago, it looks a lot different than it does now. And so that can affect your outcome. But if you got in at the right place, which you did, you get out of there and you're still making a little bit of money or breaking even on that deal. And then you've got those other deals that did so well that overall you're doing great. And that's what seasoned investors do. You don't bet 1,000, right? But you win a lot. And then on your losses, they're either small or they're break even. And then overall, you keep moving forward and you go back and find other deals that are going to really work well. So I love that. And I love that you guys have figured this process out. It's very creative. And, yeah, you're right. It's like you catch on to something before everybody else does. It's like the margins are there. And then all of a sudden when it, you know, it catches on, it's like the margins start going down a little bit. You start looking around for something else. But where do you think this market is going? I know you said there's a housing shortage where you are. Has it gotten more challenging to sell the properties that you're building? Are they jumping off the market? Are you having to reduce your prices? Or where do you think all this is going over the next 12 months?
So what we've kind of learned is, you know, that when the rates started going up pretty quickly about a year ago and they doubled real fast, that's where the consumer panic kicked in and everyone's like, I'm out, this is going to 2008. And then what had happened is, yes, the market deflated probably like in the Pacific Northwest 15-20% pretty quickly, but that was off peak, not median home price average. That was from the peak where, because also before those rates went up, we had this hockey stick like I've never seen before, and homes were appreciating like 10% a month, which is that should not ever happen. It's, and that spooked me pretty good in general. But we saw about this 20% to 25% come off. And then what happened is consumers started realizing there's really still nothing for sale, not a whole lot of inventory is coming on. And it started getting consumed. And now we've seen it actually rebound back up, probably like a good 5-10% from the bottom of the peak. But we are selling all our properties. We're getting good money for them. It just takes longer now. It's okay not to sell your property in the first 2 weeks as long as you've accounted for it in your debt cost. On average, because we're selling brand new product or highly renovated homes, we're at the top echelon of the pricing because we're the best product. There's less buyers for the top echelon of the market, so you have to be patient. But, you know, like, it was weird. Even on a townhome site we had listed, we had no showings over 2 weeks or one or two. And then we sold 4 last weekend, all for around list price. And so we're just adding about 2 to 3 months of debt cost onto every deal to get rid of them. So we're at a point where things are selling for about list price, right in there. You just have to be patient for it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, let's transition into how can people connect with you, find out more about you, and things like that.
Well, probably the easiest way to find us is on Bigger Pockets on the Market podcast. We have two episodes a week. We're constantly on bringing on different interviewers, but we do a lot of education just around the Pacific Northwest and nationwide. And I mean, the best way to find me is on Instagram. And actually, I'm pretty active with responding to people with questions, because we like to get, it's like if someone has a question that could really help move the needle, we want to help them with that, right? Because we're all trying to do the same thing, move the needle, get to financial freedom. So the easiest way is probably on Instagram at jdaneflips, or our educational program is jamesdaner.com. And that's just more of a coaching where we're taking people through going. It's a 12-year mentorship with me where we're every week we're hanging out for 2 hours. We're going through benchmarks, not concepts. I'm not into concepts. Concepts are great, but it's like, how do you move the needle next? What's the next step? And that's what we go over. You're here. How do you get here? Well, this is your next step. Then there's another step. Then it kind of, you know, then let's turn it into a domino instead of snaps and watch it all fall down. But, definitely check us out on those two platforms.
That's awesome, man. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on the show. Love to have you anytime you'd want to come back. And thanks for sharing all the information on how you're doing these value add deals. Super interesting stuff. I know I learned a lot. And yeah, man, appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Josiah. It's good catching up.
Absolutely, man. All right, we'll catch you next time.
See you, bud.